Good morning. We'd like to call the January 9th, 2024, 10 a.m. post-council session to order, located at 410 West, 9800 South, third floor of the post-council room in Sandy, Utah. As a matter of those that are excused today, we'd like to excuse Molly Sween. We'd also like to welcome Deputy Executive Director Jared Garcia to post-council. With that, I'll go ahead and ask for approval of the September 26, 2023 minutes. So do I have a motion from Spence Austin? Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
A second from John Crowley. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Hearing none, the motion passes. Go ahead and have quarterly reports from Sergeant Dave Barnett and Captain Kristen Newman.
Good morning. I'm not sure you can hear me there. For the following quarter, September 1st, 2023 to November 30th, 2023, Post received 78 complaints. We opened 33 investigations, had one administrative hearing conducted, and closed 11 cases with no action. There were five voluntary relinquishments received. The first was for aggravated assault and criminal mischief. The second was also for aggravated assault and criminal mischief. The third was for forcible sex abuse. The fourth for lying under Garrity and sexual conduct on duty. And the fifth was for possession of a controlled substance, unfit for duty, dishonest in violation of policy, threats of violence, and insurance fraud. As far as application backgrounds completed, there were 220 basic training applications reviewed, 20 dispatcher applications reviewed, and 32 waiver reactivation applications reviewed. There are currently 130 open cases, 120 active cases. I know these are high numbers. In November, Jonathan Boyd started as an investigator, as our fifth investigator. He came from SBI. He's got an extensive experience working with chiefs and sheriffs. He started his law enforcement career in 2009 in Indiana, and in 2017 came to Utah. Jonathan, you want to step up so you can see who you are? Just in way of some information, in 2023, Post opened 141 cases, and we closed 102. Currently, there's multiple cases with criminal action pending, and a quick analysis showed that those cases are causing a delay of about 285 days in getting those cases closed. And currently, each Post investigator is averaging about 26 cases of a caseload. We are hoping to have our sixth investigator by the end of the month, but keep our fingers crossed. Hope nothing else changes there. Any questions for me? Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Until we select a new lieutenant, I'll be pulling double duty. So for basic training for the quarter of September 1st to November 30th, we held four basic training academies. We had 32 start in the first one, and 36 start in the second, 31 start in the third, and we currently have a Leo block with 53 enrolled, which is one of our biggest classes. We tend to cap even the splits at 60. For the attrition rates, we're at 6.2% for the quarter, which is slightly higher than we usually are. But most of the attrition, in fact, I think in this quarter, all of the attrition was due to cadets not making standard either in DT or PT. Upcoming academies for this upcoming quarter, we've got Post 377 is topped out at 40 enrolled. That's running from February 20th to April 25th of this year. Session 378 has 41 enrolled, and it's topped out as well. It starts on February 26th, going to June 13th. And 379 is open now for slot reservations. We have eight enrolled. So for in-service training, we held 29 in-service classes across a number of topics. We trained 559 officers after enrolling 666, and we trained a total of 32 dispatchers for the quarter and a total of 536 hours of training. Any questions on basic training? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from John Jacobs on the 23-24 quarter three curriculum update.
Good morning, Council. I'll give you an update on what our curriculum team has been doing. We're finally fully staffed. We have Ryan Fulmer here with next to Chris. He is our new media production. He took that position when Chris was promoted to the e-learning developer. As far as curriculum goes for this quarter, we've been really focused on the kind of the other items that I'll go to. We don't have at this time any requests for changes to curriculum. That will be upcoming, especially after legislative session. We'll evaluate what changes happen there and then how the curriculum will be affected. We do have some things that we are working on in the officer wellness and resiliency, mental health area and crime scene protection and search. Those are some things that we're starting to evaluate and update in our curriculum. So that is our kind of the update for the curriculum. But kind of the big thing we've been working on is instructor development. Instructor development has been a in-service certificate that's been offered and it's been part of the mid-management certificate. Part of evaluating moving towards a competency-based type education system is understanding that we need educators in the classroom. We need instructors that are not lecturers. We need them to be facilitators. And the people that come and teach to us, they have a varying degree of ability to really facilitate discussions. They have a great amount of wealth and experience, and it's very beneficial. But we realize that we need to provide some type of instructor development that helps get the instructors comfortable with running a dynamic, engaged classroom of discussions and that. So we're looking at this instructor development rebuild, and we surveyed. There's 2,000 active instructor development certificate holders that are officers today. About 400 or 500 of them responded to a survey that we did, asking them what they liked about the program, what they didn't like, what they would like to see in the future. And then also we've been working with post-curriculum committee to get feedback from them on kind of our initial standards. So the initial plan is moving forward. We'll be coming to you later with policy changes on this. But we're looking at having an online course that is what we call the core. And this core is the basis of in how to present and teach and engage cadets and in-service officers in the classroom and in different areas. And then having endorsements. Traditionally, when we looked at national programs for instructor development, they're typically 1 week or 2 weeks long, and they go a breadth of you're writing the lesson plan, you're teaching the lesson plan, you're doing online, you're doing scenarios, you're doing physical skills. And even if you only need to teach in the classroom or you only need to be a firearms instructor on the range, you're still getting this wide breadth of all the way to the point where how to write instructional objectives and how to write lesson plans. And so what we looked at, and this is the plan we're looking at moving forward, is having every person complete this core online course that gives kind of a foundation of being an instructor, and then having what we call endorsements. And these endorsements will have one for classroom and one for a scenario program. So if you're assigned to run a scenario program, you would take the core and then that scenario. Or if you were tasked with your agency to create training and you need that specific skill of how to write lesson plans and objectives and test questions, then you would just come to that more specific focus class. So instead of giving everybody a broad scope, we limit it down to if you know you're going to be a post instructor in a classroom or you're going to be an in-service instructor, that you would come to the class that would give you the actionable skills for that classroom. And then later in your career, if you decide that you want to, you know, come to an instructor development or a scenario, we're even looking at one where how to manage an academy or how to manage an in-service training program from a very like administrative level. Those are kind of the endorsements we're looking at. So we'll be further developing that as we move along. And then also we're enveloping what we already have with our firearms instructor and our DT and our EVO, recognizing those as endorsements too. So a person that goes to defensive tactics will get a little bit more of this, how to be an instructor and that will satisfy their instructor development program versus having to go to a week or 2 weeks of defensive tactics and then go to another 3 or 4 days of instructor development. We're going to try and incorporate all those items in. And so we're still in the kind of the working out some things like that. And so next council will bring you more information on this program, but it's going to be exciting to have a kind of a comprehensive program. And we're developing this program. So if agencies want to have a train the trainer program, or they want to envelop this program more into their agency beyond the resources of post, we're creating a way that agencies, some of the top level instructors with the agencies, can become trainers and they can host the program within the agency or the region as needed. So I'll take any feedback or questions, comments, concerns on instructor development. Okay. All right.
Did you have anything to add? I just has on the agenda a new curriculum committee member.
Yeah. So I'll go through these last couple things and then we'll get to that.
Would you clarify how long the core class is for everyone?
The core, we're looking at probably 2 or 3 hours online. Yeah. So the person will have that online course. And then if they are going to be a facilitator in a classroom, we're hoping that we can get that down to a one day class, because if they've done all the work online, typically right now with our instructor development, they come for a day and then they go home and prepare a presentation the next day. And then they come back on the third day and kind of give that presentation. And it kind of stretches out an officer's commitment across 3 days. We're hoping that they can dynamically take whenever their schedules is available to do the online homework and the prep work. And then we can only dedicate that officer for maybe a day or a day and a half actually in the classroom. And so that'll reduce the amount of time.
So like a firearms instructor, a new firearms instructor would do the core class, the 3-hour core class,
yeah,
and then go through the practical week of firearms training?
Yeah, so a firearms instructor will just do that online core and then go through the regular firearms instructor course that we have. And from that, they will come out with an instructor development certificate plus their firearm certificate. And so, because we've seen where those officers that are doing that tend to, once they come away with a DT instructor or firearms or EVO instructor, then they're retasked again to go to another 3 days of instructor development. And so it's streamlining a couple of our programs together.
Had an opportunity as part of a subcommittee to look at the curriculum and the plan. And I think at first, when you first look at it, it looks very complex. When you really get into it, it makes sense. It has good flow. I like what you've done. I think it's a good approach. And I know it's been a lot of work. I can tell just by reviewing it that it's been a lot of work. But I like it. I think it's looking good.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I think I believe it's going to fill a need that we have at post to have the instructors, but I also believe that this is going to be a thing that is going to greatly enhance law enforcement as a whole to provide some training and information. And we even have one for online, because a lot of agencies are looking like, how do I get something online? How do I do this? And so we're looking at running even a course to say this is your best practices to do online blended training in your agency. So those things will help.
I'd also like to add, when I was looking at coming over here and where I thought we as post needed to improve, it was in curriculum development. And I was happy to see that the groundwork had already been laid, and now we're just starting to see the fruit of those efforts, where we want to have professional curriculum that stands up to professional curriculum development standards and academic standards. That, and I think it'll benefit everyone in the state, be a resource to all the departments. That's our goal, is to be a resource to everybody. And we bring the professional, the curriculum developers will help us all.
Okay, the next thing we're tasked with, and this is, you know, what the major had asked us to look at, is our safety protocols around any type of training. Whether it's scenario, defensive tactics, firearms, like what is post policy on safety, especially when we run these dynamic scenarios? Are we sweeping the room for any unsafe items? Are we proper signage? Are we are we having a safety brief before the training, understanding, you know, making sure that the participants are safe and secure in their thing, and we have that kind of in our policy in different places, and observing our scenario program, they certainly do a scenario brief, but one thing we see is that it's not documented that a safety brief had occurred before a firearms day or before an EVO day. And so we're looking at reworking the policy and integrating the ability that we have a system where whatever instructor it is, they on their phone, they can bring up a form that has the safety checklist. For example, a scenario, is proper signage up? Has the room been swept for any unsafe items? And of course, when we talk scenario, you know, unsafe items could be, you know, anything that could come into play. Have they been briefed on, you know, when to call out a roll, when to stop the training? And so all that will be documented at the beginning of the training day, and we're going to put it on an online system where all of our academies can simply check the box, fill in their name, do a little, fingertip signature, and then that gets documented that the safety brief had been occurred and that everybody, all the participants, the role players, everybody had that safety brief. And along with that is we're creating some online courses that say, if you're going to be a role player, take this very short 15-20 minute safety training video. If you're going to be an evaluator, if you're going to be a participant, participate in this online training to have you understand the rules of training and around safety. And then before every training day, we'll have a safety brief that's documented so that we know that everything is, all the marks have been checked before we start training. And so that's another one that we're working on that will be coming with a policy change and a kind of a way of doing business change on that also. Any questions on that? Okay, a few more items, sorry. Okay, job task analysis. So we are running our job task analysis. We have a small group. We have the job tasks identified. What the job task analysis is going to allow us to do is we're querying, and this is for a law enforcement officer certification, we're validating all the tasks that an officer would do. And we have to cull that list because national lists that have been done and the one that we have, the average officer has 720 tasks that they do in the profession. Some of them are a little more specialized, but there is a lot of tasks. And so what we're doing is we're having a group come together of different agencies represented, and they're going to cull that list down, and then we're going to send this out to agencies, to administrators, and to line officers and mid-level, and ask them, you know, what is the frequency of this task? What is the importance of this task? And then with the administrators, we're going to ask the additional question, where do you feel this task should be taught? Should this be something they come to the job already knowing? Is this a task that we should come to competency in the academy before they leave? Is this a task that they should just have an awareness in the academy before they leave? Or is this something that's reserved for the field training officer program or even advanced officer training? So once we can kind of gather up all that data, we can look at the curriculum and say, for example, even the tasks that, you know, this typically comes from HR departments, you know, must be able to type on a keyboard. Well, that's something we could say the cadet should come before they're even hired before that. And we can identify those things that happen before. And this helps the agencies once we have a validated statewide task analysis. This is something the HR departments can use to validate your hiring procedures, saying that, you know, this has been a validated study that says these are the skills that you should possess before hiring. And then for us at Post, we look at specifically, these are the tasks we should have competency in the academy, and these are the tasks that we should have an awareness in the academy. And then from that, we can look at our curriculum and say, are we meeting those tasks? And then the tasks that are identified should happen in field training, we can give back to the agencies and say, here is what your field training program ideally should accomplish. Here's a guideline for you of tasks that have been identified that should happen in FTO. And then the agencies can use that information to their benefit. So we are working on the initial small committee to validate the tasks, and then we'll be sending it out to statewide for all the chiefs and sheriffs and agencies to respond to that. And then once that, we'll do a statistical analysis, and we'll bring all the information back together and hopefully have a presentation in July or in the September post-council for you. Any questions on that? Sorry, we're busy. Okay, last item is Post has acquired a license for Canvas. Canvas is the online software program that a lot of you might be aware of because it's K-12, it's higher education, and we have acquired a license just for basic training. This is not in service. We're still using Acadus, but we're using Canvas. We're incubating it right now. We're looking at using Canvas in basic training only. There's several benefits to that beyond just doing their online training. The cadets are able to submit their weekly journals in the system. They're able to submit they write a report after scenario training. They're able to submit that report. It's able for us to integrate into looking at the cadets' progress through the academy on a little micro level. We're able to offer them some self-assessment quizzes to let them practice. We have some flashcards in the system. So Canvas is just going to be able to give us the ability to work more on the things that agencies have requested us to work on, which is their ability to communicate and report right. And before, the cadets would send it all to us, and it would be, you know, either an email or Google Drive, and it was hard to grade, it was hard to track. Canvas gives us the ability to apply a rubric to the report, and we can have an external reviewer look at the report and grade them, and it sends them back their feedback like you would expect from like a K-12 or higher education type teacher. And so we are working. We have two classes that have started using Canvas. We even have the new class writing a 5-minute reflection after every class. So they had BCI and post-investigations class yesterday, and that night the class had a little tiny assignment to write a 5-minute reflection. What did I learn? What don't I understand? What do I need to know about this area? And we're hoping that if they formalize these thoughts, it'll help them in studying. But what we're really trying to do with this is if they can gain the confidence that they know the content, then when they go to scenario training, this is the feedback we get from our scenario is they just don't have that confidence that they know the material, and so they kind of are hesitant. So we're hoping that if we get them more confident academically, that we'll actually see a better performance where we're looking for. We're looking for the better performance in their ability to perform in a scenario, then eventually go to you and perform better in field training. And so we're going all the way back to the very roots of being able to communicate and articulate a concept, either verbally or written. And we hope that we'll see some improvement. We're interested to see. We've had for a while now our professional communications class where we have the students actually stand up and give a presentation and write a essay, kind of an academic paper. We're interested to see as we have our debriefs with the agencies, if that is translating into, you know, better writing skills and better interpersonal skills. So these are some things we're working on with. And we needed a technology piece to do it, and Canvas did that. So we were able to acquire that and get going. Go ahead.
It is a good system. Yeah. Canvas is. So if you can get it here for your cadets, working with higher ed as well as public ed, we've been using it for a long time. It's great.
Yeah, there was a lot of things we wanted to do with the cadets, but logistically we couldn't do it with Acadus. Acadus is an amazing program for agency tracking, training, certification. But yeah, in the classroom, there was nothing we could find that could help us logistically do these things we wanted to do with the cadets. And for quite a while, we've tried different things with evaluating reports. But yeah, it's given us the peace now that we can handle getting the cadets to submit more work to us. So, yeah, so we have two sessions running through it right now. And it's great to see. You ask the cadets how many people have used Canvas, and you get half the class raise their hand. So it's a tool that the cadets are very familiar with because of Canvas being integrated into our schools. And so we're looking forward to this being a good product for us. Okay. The last thing is we do have an opening on the curriculum committee. We have one slot open, so we'd like to ask to have that position replaced with a new person.
That would be somebody that would come from post council?
Yeah.
We have anyone that might be interested in serving on that committee?
Yeah, that might be helpful. We have Colonel Rappage, we have Sheriff Squires, and then we have
Miley's on that as well.
Miley, yeah.
I'd be willing to if I'm not already on that.
Okay. Yeah. I believe that's just a vote that we...
Okay. Well, I'd like a motion to accept Melina Stevens to serve on the curriculum committee.
So moved.
So moved.
Got a motion. Second. Sheriff Sparks. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion passes. Welcome.
Okay. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We'll now turn the time over to Mark Ashaki on administrative rules updates. So.
If you recall from the last meeting, we talked about these two rules. So Utah Admin Code R728, 403, and 409. There were some questions that came up regarding some of the language. I believe we've addressed that language. We sent this out again to the council members. I'm trying to get this up. Let's see. Give me 2 seconds. Oh, we extend this. Okay, so I believe we've addressed the issue on this one. We just needed to address the unless it is for a traffic offense. That is a Class C misdemeanor infraction. So we've addressed the concern that was brought up by the council members at the last meeting. And this is on 403. There was no other comments on this one. So in regards to this one, I believe we had all the concerns addressed. And then on this other one, on 409, we had some concerns regarding while off duty. Here under subsection C, there was just some concerns raised by Sheriff Sparks in regards to the language there. And I believe we've addressed that language. We also addressed some additional language there regarding soliciting, requesting, or directing another to engage in any acts described above, and we further clarified the acts, the sexual conduct, acts of masturbation, sexual intercourse, or any of the blank, blank, blank. We had some issues come up regarding a recent matter where it was, is this a still image? Is this a video? So this is just to clarify that it's any of the above. It's just if you're transmitting any type of image, whether it's video, still image or anything, it would still fall within sexual conduct while on duty. So I believe we've addressed everything. With that, the hope is that we can push this forward to the Utah Rules Committee for their approval and get this in. Do I have any concerns from any of the council members in regards to this?
Don't see anything.
Okay. It does say, as per the advice of the council, in regards, in the past, we've asked for a motion. It's up to you guys. It is per the advice of the council, but I'll let you guys decide how you guys want to proceed in that case.
We have a motion to accept.
I'll make a motion to accept as presented rules 409 and 403.
Second.
Mayor Walker. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We'll get appreciate those in. Moving on to the next agenda item, it is the disciplinary matters. I'm actually going to have attorney David Morris Putzer. He's going to be assisting me on a few of these matters today, and the first one he will be handling. So,
thank you, counsel. Again, I'm David Morris Putzer, one of the attorneys who represents DPS and Post. The first matter for our disciplinary cases today is the matter of Adam Alfaro. I don't know that he's present today. Mr. Alfaro was an employee of Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office with 9 years of service. He committed domestic violence in the presence of his child. So there was an incident that occurred where he got into an argument with his wife, and he ended up punching multiple holes in the walls of their house. There were two minor children who were present in the home at the time. Mr. Alfaro ultimately admitted this conduct in a Garrity interview conducted by his agency. As part of the employment investigation, he was placed on administrative leave on June 29th of 2022, and he was ultimately terminated on December 12th of 2022 as a result of that conduct. Mr. Alfaro was charged with criminal mischief and two counts of domestic violence in the presence of a child, and ultimately entered a plea in abeyance to the criminal mischief charge alone. I believe that plea in abeyance has been fully completed. And that plea agreement was entered November of 2022. This is a Category C and E offense, C for the criminal mischief. And the baseline for the Category C offense would be 2 years, with the guidelines range of 9 months to 3.5 years. Here, Post is recommending a 2.5-year suspension of Mr. Alfaro's certifications. We think that's appropriate. Post believes that's appropriate, particularly where the baseline is 2 years and there's the aggravating circumstance of multiple offenses in this case. Are there any questions about the Matt Alfaro matter?
Seeing no, I just want to double check. We may got to make sure we don't have counsel present on his behalf. Is that correct?
Thank you. Apologize, Chair.
I move to accept Post recommendation for 2.5-year suspension.
I've got a motion to accept on behalf of Sheriff Sparks. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. Jeanette Williams. Any further discussion?
I have a clarifying question. Is that 2.5-year suspension to begin from the date of separation from the agency or from today?
Or from admin leave.
From the date of admin leave. Yes, it was on today. Is that correct?
I think it's, was his admin leave paid or unpaid? Do we know?
It was paid. So he was married, but he did not have any powers. So it'd be termination date, is that correct? Not
12/12/22. He had police powers.
He no longer exercised police powers while on admin leave.
Exercised or had?
Leave his agency. Said, you know, I guess he would have answered on that one, whether he had them, even if he wasn't exercising. I don't think he would have.
As a correctional officer, he did not have powers outside his post.
So if I'm not mistaken, I think our practice has been from date of separation in the past, and I think making a distinction between a law enforcement officer and a correctional officer is going to create a real discrepancy in how we handle cases, so I would make the motion that the suspension start on date of separation.
So we have a motion to accept date of separation.
I'll second that motion.
That's second, John Crowley. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
The next matter before the council is the matter of Ronnie Boyd. He is formerly employed with the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office with 5 years of service. Substantiated allegation is child abuse, neglect, two counts, and then failure to report child abuse. This falls under Category C and E of the post-disciplinary guidelines, which is a 2-year baseline. We are recommending 3 years, and the reason for that is because of the multiple offenses that we have here. He was terminated on 12/5 of 22, and the summary of the facts are as follows. Ronnie Boyd was investigated by DCFS and a local police agency for several acts of child abuse and failing to report child abuse. The abuse of or neglect included shooting his youngest stepdaughter with a paintball gun and slapping his oldest stepdaughter in the face. Boyd later pled guilty to one count of failure to report child abuse and two counts of child abuse neglect. His employment with Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office was terminated as a result of the investigation. Any questions?
Any
And if you recall, the counter offense, Mr. Boyd's spouse was on the previous council meeting. So just to bring that up. So we did have one that was very similar on the last council meeting.
For the record, Mr. Boyd isn't here and he doesn't have counsel present. Is that correct?
So he was charged with both counts?
He was charged with, yeah, so two counts on child abuse neglect and then one count of failure to report child abuse.
What was the post rationale for 3 years versus 3.5 years?
Compared to Cassie Boyd, the other individual? We just went with the multiple offenses. We generally just up it a half a year for each offense, and so in this case we just went with the 3 years.
Any further questions? Do we have a motion?
I move that we accept the post recommendation for 3 years to begin on date of termination.
We have a motion to accept from Melina Stevens. Do we have a second? Second from Spence Austin. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Jared Chuckren. Was not employed at the time of the offense. Substantiated allegation is threat of violence and harassment. This falls under category C and D of the post-disciplinary guidelines with a two-year baseline. Post-recommendation is 2.5 years, so 2.5 years, and this is based on the multiple offenses as the aggravating factor. A summary of the facts are as follows. Jared Chuckren was investigated by a local police agency for making threats of violence. The investigation disclosed that on May 30th, 2022, Chuckren went to the home of a city worker and confronted and threatened to make the city worker bleed all over his house in front of his family. Chuckren also made threats through text messages to a former supervisor, threatening to kill the supervisor and slit his daughter's throat. The threats caused the supervisor to take his family from their home to a different location to ensure the safety of the family. The case was screened with the county attorney and charges were filed on Chuckren for two counts of threats of violence. Chuckren later pled guilty to one charge of threat of violence and a second count was dismissed. During a Garrity interview with Post, Chuckren said he does not have a great memory of what occurred. He said he does have a vague memory of being at the city worker's home and touching him, but Chuckren does not remember anything he said to the city worker. Chuckren does not remember sending any text messages to his former supervisor. Chuckren said the psychiatric break is the reason he does not remember what happened that day, but does not deny the incidents occurred. Chuckren said he spent multiple days in the psychiatric unit at the local hospital and is currently going to counseling.
Before this at all by
he was employed by an agency before this, yes. It would have been, I believe, Saratoga Springs.
Does this rise to the level that we need to consider fitness for duty?
Probably have to go to a session if that's the case. We need to
discuss this. But unless Post puts forward his mental state or treatment. I mean, it's all... Once we talk about it, right?
Well, could we accept the post recommendation and require that before he's reinstated, he needs to go through a psych eval by a licensed psychologist as we have in the past?
I think that's what we've done in the past.
It is.
That would be consistent.
Then I would make that motion.
I have a motion to accept the post counsel's recommendation and have it prior to being eligible to be reinstated, he would have to have a psychological evaluation from the psychiatrist. We have
second. I think psychologist.
Thank you.
I'll second that.
Second from Mayor Walker. Any further discussions?
So would it not make more sense you just make it a category G violation so that it's already sitting there waiting for, because that requires some sort of fitness for duty review or some sort of fit for duty.
Maybe the issue I would have with category B is there is no time period.
Right, it's indefinite.
So he could essentially come back to work immediately without any type of suspension.
Right. Okay.
And that's why we brought it as a 2.5 year, because we have at least a bare minimum of 2.5 years, and that's why we brought it as a CND.
But he can't issue the suspension and...
Not under that category. So that's why we stayed with the category CND. Under G, we don't have, it's just the indefinite time period. He could come back if he satisfies it tomorrow. But if we have the C, we have at least that bare minimum of 2.5 years.
Any further discussion?
When was the 2.5 year start? From the date of the incident or from today? Because he wasn't employed at the time, so he wasn't.
Apparently, he was employed at the time, is that correct?
He was not employed at the time.
I would propose from today.
From today. My second stands.
Second. Any further discussion? Anything else? Hearing none, I call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Tanner Cooley, formerly employed with the Utah Department of Corrections. Its substantiated allegation is possession or use of a controlled substance, which falls under Category D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. The guideline baseline is 1 year, and POST is recommending a 1 year suspension. Terminated on 2/24 of 23, and a summary of the facts are as follows. Tanner Cooley was investigated by his agency for using marijuana. The investigation disclosed that on October 21st, 2022, Cooley went to a wedding in Oregon and consumed brownies that contained marijuana. Cooley did not know the brownies contained marijuana until he started to feel the effects of the marijuana use. Cooley decided later that night to smoke marijuana because he had already consumed the marijuana brownie. Cooley returned to work after the wedding and informed co-workers that he had used marijuana. Cooley was terminated. No criminal charges were filed. During Garrity interviews with UDC and Post, Cooley said he has diabetes and was feeling like his blood sugar was low. Cooley said after consuming the brownies, he was told by his friends that the brownies contained marijuana. Later that evening, his friends asked him if he wanted to smoke marijuana. Cooley decided that he was already in trouble with his agency and decided to smoke marijuana with his friends. Just to be clear, we are taking action based on the smoking of the marijuana, not on the consumption of the brownies.
Yeah. Mr. Cooley, his legal representation is not here, is that correct?
Everybody in the hallway.
Okay. Any questions for counsel? Oh, for the record, we'll have corrections recuse themselves. Do we have a motion?
Motion to accept. We'll make a motion that we accept the recommendation.
We have a motion to accept. Second from John Crowley. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the motion. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Next matter before the council is the certification of Christopher Arrett, formerly employed with the Unified Police Department. Substantiated allegation is theft, which falls under Category D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. The guideline baseline is 1 year, and POST is recommending a 1 year suspension. Mr. Arrett was terminated on 5/20 of 2023. And the summary of the facts are as follows. Christopher Arrett was investigated by his agency for theft. The investigation disclosed that Arrett responded to an assault call as an assisting officer. During the call, Arrett placed a dog that belonged to the family in the back of his patrol vehicle and took the dog home for 5 days. Arrett claimed he was fostering the dog until he could contact the owner. After returning to work, Arrett informed his supervisors that he had the dog. The investigation later found that Arrett had told a co-worker that he had stolen the dog. Arrett was placed on administrative leave and later terminated by his agency, and no criminal charges were filed. During a Garrity interview with Post, Arrett said he had put the dog in his vehicle and did not remember the dog was in the vehicle until he returned to his residence. Arrett said his intentions were to foster the dog until he could contact the owner of the dog. Arrett did not ask for the owner's name or contact information and did not make any attempts to return the dog or notify anyone that he had the dog for 5 days. Arrett did not return to the residence where he took the dog, and prior to the assault call that night, Arrett had stopped a vehicle that the assault suspect was in which the suspect stated he was selling the dog for $200.
Is Mr. Arrett here or his counsel? I have a question
before we make a motion. So, I mean, with this, there's the theft, but there's also the dishonesty. And was there consideration, it sounds like, for the information that you had, that there potentially was some dishonesty during the Garrity interview? At least the facts didn't seem to line up with what he told his co-worker as far as he stole the dog. And then, oh, I forgot the dog was in there, and I tried to return it. Just seems like there's some honesty concerns as well, and I just wonder if we need to take that into consideration.
I'm going to turn some time over to Sergeant Barnett.
Sergeant Barnett with Post. The Garrity interview, he was he admitted to taking the dog. As far as the dishonesty portion of it, he disagrees that the statement about the stolen dog was there, and so it's one person's version versus another person's version of what happened in there. But the facts that he didn't reach out to anybody, including the investigating officer, for contact information is why we went after the theft and not the dishonesty.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
I'll make a motion to accept. My motion to accept from Sheriff Wimmer. Do I have a second?
I'll second them. Still employed?
No, terminated from Unified. Terminated on 5/20/2023.
Effective from the termination date.
We got a second to accept termination from the termination date. Any further discussion? Go ahead and call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. Motion passes.
Thank you. The next matter before the council is the certification of Tiffany Hall, formerly employed with the Davis County Sheriff's Office. Substantiated allegation is possession or use of a controlled substance, which falls under Category D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. The guideline baseline is 1 year, and his post is recommending a 1 year suspension. Ms. Hall resigned on 1/19/23 from Davis County Sheriff's. Summary of the facts are as follows. Tiffany Hall was investigated by her agency for possession or use of a controlled substance. The investigation disclosed that on October 19, 2022, Hall participated in a Garrity interview with her department as part of another officer's administrative investigation. During that Garrity interview, Hall admitted that in May of 2021, she went on a trip to Washington and smoked marijuana from a marijuana cigarette or joint. Hall resigned in lieu of termination, and no charges were filed. During a Garrity interview with Post, Hall admitted she smoked marijuana on one occasion during the trip to Washington. Hall said that this is the only time she's ever used marijuana.
For the record, Sheriff Sparks will recuse himself. Any questions for counsel? Hearing none, call for the vote.
You're here.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
So I just wanted to say that I'm so sorry. In the moment, I made a poor decision and definitely learned that it was not worth it in more ways than one. This experience has taught me far more lessons than I'd ever imagined, and I'm so sorry that you all are needing to take the time out of your days due to my mistake. I'm here to ask for leniency so that I can get back on with the department and do my part to contribute to the law enforcement community again. It's definitely not a path I will ever venture down again. Thanks for your time, guys.
Any questions for Ms. Hall? Hearing none, do I have a motion?
Motion to accept post recommendation.
I have a motion to accept post recommendation.
Second.
Got a second. Is that from termination date?
She'll be up in 10 days.
Yep, 10 days.
So we got a second. Any further discussion? Hearing
Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Next matter before the council is certification of Brian Jensen, formerly employed with the Washington County Sheriff's Office for 16 years of service. Substantiated allegation is sexual conduct on duty. I believe multiple counts on that, and then possession or use of a controlled substance. This falls under categories B and D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. The guideline baseline for that is 3 years, and post is recommending 4 years based on the aggravating factors of multiple offenses. Resigned from Washington County on 11-17 of 2022, and a summary of the facts are as follows. Brian Jensen was investigated by his agency for engaging in sexual conduct on duty and possession or use of a controlled substance. The investigation disclosed that during the year of 2022, Jensen used THC on at least 3 occasions. The investigation also found that Jensen engaged in sexual activity while on duty on several occasions. The case was not screened for criminal charges, and Jensen resigned in lieu of termination. During Garrity interviews with his agency and post, Jensen admitted to using THC on at least 3 occasions while off duty, and also admitted to engaging in oral sex and sexual intercourse while on duty on at least 7 different occasions. Jensen said he was in uniform, being compensated by his department, and was available during for calls during those events.
It's Mr. Jensen here. See no one rising. We have a motion.
I move that we accept the post recommendation for 4 year suspension to begin at date of term resignation 11-17-22.
We have a motion to accept from Elaine Stevens, second from Mayor Walker. Any further discussions? Hearing none, we'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes.
Next matter before the council is the certification of Teresa Osborne, formerly employed with the Utah Department of Corrections, adult probation and parole, with 19 years of service. Substantiated allegation is communication fraud and falsification of a government record. This falls under category A and D of the post-disciplinary guidelines. The baseline for such guideline is revocation, and post is recommending that baseline of revocation. We also have aggravating circumstances of multiple offenses and the fraud slash theft of approximately $4,500. We have a termination of 9/29 of 2023, and the summary of the facts are as follows. Teresa Osborne was investigated by her agency for theft and falsification of government records after her supervisor discovered that Osborne claimed an unusually large number of work hours on her time cards and received pay for those hours. During the investigation, her agency discovered 15 time cards with suspicious entries. During Garrity interviews with her agency and post, Osborne admitted that she added hours to her time card that she did not physically or actually work. Osborne's hours during the week included work on her regular caseload, work on special projects, and work during voluntary overtime shifts. Osborne would record the actual hours she worked on her time cards, but then add the amount of time she worked on her regular caseload during her voluntary overtime shifts. Consequently, Osborne double counted the time she worked during those overtime shifts. She claimed she was extra productive and her efforts added value to the department and that she should receive compensation. Just to note, she was placed on administrative leave on 3-1 of 2023 with her date of separation of 9-29 of 23. Yes.
The voluntary work, does that mean she is working unpaid or she's volunteering for a paid?
It's a special assignment. It's a voluntary special assignment that she was placed on. It's not, she was still getting compensated for that.
Is Ms. Osborne present, counsel? See no one rising. For the record, Executive Deputy Director Garcia will recuse himself. Do we have a motion?
I move that we accept the post recommendation for revocation.
I got just one question before the second. So we just had a theft case where you're recommending a year, and we've got another theft case where you're recommending revocation. Not that I disagree, I'm just...
So it's actually, this is more of a communication fraud because she is transmitting the hours. So it satisfies the communication fraud, which falls under category A, whereas the other one is actually a theft. So I said theft, just it's the taking of $4,500, but it is through via communication fraud. So it's a different mechanism.
Thank you. All right, I'll second her motion.
We got a motion to accept from Lena Stevens and a second from Chief Swanson. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the motion, or the vote, rather. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
The next matter before the council is Alyssa Osborne. She is currently employed with the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. Substantiated allegation is willfully falsifying information to obtain certification. This falls under category C of the post-disciplinary guidelines. The guideline baseline is 2 years, and post is recommending 2 years in this matter. And she is, like I said, still employed in this with the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. Summary of the facts are as follows. Alyssa Osborne submitted a post application on June 4th, 2019. The application was approved, and Osborne received her post certification. Osborne began working as a corrections officer after becoming certified. On May 6, 2023, Osborne submitted a background check packet to the Salt Lake City Police Department. The assigned background check investigator found a Salt Lake City Police Department report which stated Osborne intentionally overdosed on prescription medication. Osborne was found next to an empty bottle of muscle relaxers after making the threats to kill herself. Osborne was pink sheeted as a result. The background check investigator noted discrepancies between the report and her application. During a post-Garrity interview with Osborne, she admitted to intentionally falsifying her post-application. And I believe she is, Ms. Osborne is here.
I just wanted to apologize for falsifying that information at the time. I was very nervous of the stigma of mental health. I had just gone through a divorce, and so I haven't struggled since then. I've had counseling. I just ask for leniency so that I can get back to my job.
Did you state you had counseling or have not had counseling?
Have had counseling.
Any further questions from Ms. Osborne?
Counseling, was that prior to working for Department of Corrections, or was that counseling during your work with...
It was prior.
It was prior.
Prior and during.
And then you mentioned to get back to your job. Are you still employed or on some sort
I'm
of
on
leave?
Admin leave.
Okay. From what date?
It was approximately a month ago. I'm not certain exactly what date I was on admin leave.
Have you sought treatment for the overdose or anything like that?
Like mental health treatment?
Probably ain't going
to. It's up to you guys. So, and I did advise Ms. Osborne that if she wanted, she does not have counsel here, but if she wanted, if we are getting into mental health discussion.
I move that we go into closed session for to discuss the mental health. What is that motion?
The mental health of
individuals.
We have a motion to go into closed in a second. From Mayor Walker.
Needs to be by name.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We'll go ahead and go into closed session. Anyone that is not on closed council,
we have a motion. Oh, go ahead. All right. Do we have a motion?
I'll move to accept Polk's recommendation for a two-year suspension.
We have a motion to accept Polk's recommendation for a two-year suspension from Sheriff Sparks. Second from Colonel Rappish. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Just for clarification. Oh. Thank you.
What's that?
I would just like to clarify the start date of that.
Okay, start date would be, what was it, 1 month from...
When do you know when you were placed on that and leave? August. We will look into that. Is that when you would like it from?
Yes.
Okay. So I will have Sergeant Young look into that date and identify that date, and we will place it from that date. Thank you. I will turn the time over to Mr. Morris Putzer for the next two matters.
Thank you, counsel. The next matter is the matter of Joseph Richardson, and I believe Mr. Richardson and his counsel are both present and will be, I assume, speaking to the counsel and able to answer questions. Mr. Richardson is an employee of the Utah County Sheriff's Office. He has 18 and a half years of service in law enforcement. I believe he's a certified law enforcement officer, though has been employed as a correctional officer. The allegations regarding Mr. Richardson are that he committed negligent homicide, which is a Category B offense with a baseline range of 3 years. The guideline range on a Category B offense is between 1.5 years and revocation. Post will be recommending a 3-year suspension of certification. Mr. Richardson disputed the allegations, and there was a hearing. After the hearing, the ALJ found that on March 16th of 2021, Mr. Richardson was responding to a SWAT call-out in Utah County, and Mr. Richardson was traveling to that call-out in his personal vehicle with no emergency lights on a wet roadway, and he ended up traveling at 58 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone and struck a vehicle that failed to yield to him as it crossed in front of his vehicle, leading to the death of the driver of the other vehicle. Mr. Richardson was charged with manslaughter and entered a plea in abeyance to negligent homicide, which is a Class A misdemeanor. I believe Mr. Richardson's agency entered a letter of reprimand against him. I believe he remains employed, and that's where we are today. Again, I believe Mr. Richardson is present and has counsel. I'm also happy to take any questions. If you'd prefer to ask me questions before speaking to him, although you can ask them to me at any time. Sheriff?
When you have a plea, though, doesn't Post usually look at it as the original charge if they can prove that within their investigation?
The plea in abeyance was to the negligent homicide, which would be reduced to a Class B, I believe, reckless driving after successful completion of the terms of the plea deal. So Post is looking at the conviction as being for negligent homicide, and that's what that's the violation found by the administrative law judge.
You mentioned that the other vehicle failed to yield, so did the other... I get the speed, but did the other vehicle run a red light? When you say failed to yield, what...
The other vehicle was turning out of a fast food restaurant and turning left across multiple lanes of traffic. Mr. Richardson was traveling, and I apologize, I don't recall whether Mr. Richardson was in the number one or number two lane of travel, and the vehicle crossed in front of him with insufficient time to make that transit, while given Mr. Richardson's rate of travel.
Were there other cars, I'm assuming, responding as well, and did they have their lights on?
The findings of the administrative law judge do not identify any other vehicles on that were responding to the incident on that stretch of roadway. I'm unaware of any at the time. I don't believe there's any other facts in the record in front of Post Counsel at this point in time.
So are you employed as a law enforcement officer at this point in time?
He's on that administrative leave.
Okay.
Sorry, if you'd like to speak, I don't mean... So, I'm happy to continue taking questions, although I don't mean to prevent Mr. Richardson from providing any information.
Any other questions for counsel?
Did the investigation reveal whether the victim in this had Mr. Richardson been doing 35? Would he have made that turn, or would there still have been a collusion?
There were disputed facts on that issue presented before the administrative law judge. Post's position on that with the factual dispute was that yes, if he had been traveling at a normal rate of speed, the other driver would have been able to make the turn. Mr. Richardson's position, I believe, and I certainly don't mean to speak for him, I'll let him answer that, was that at the time, by the time the vehicle passed in front of him, he did not have enough time to evade, given the actual rates of travel of the vehicles involved.
So that's a dispute, essentially, right now. It's not.
The administrative law judge did not issue any findings of fact on that issue. So do I and do Post have a position on that? Yes. I'm just trying to keep it very narrow to what the administrative law judge entered in the findings of fact.
Post doesn't believe that there would have been a collision had he not been speeding.
Yes, that's correct.
So then, yeah, okay. Thank you.
Counsel, Mr. Richards.
My name is Mike Petro. I represent Mr. Richardson, and may present some mitigating facts. What happened is this was on March, 16th, 2021, and the decedent, the fellow that perished in the automobile accident, he was at a drive-through window at Taco Bell. The drive-through was on the south side of the building, so it obscured Mr. Richardson from seeing him, and there was also a hedge in front of the Taco Bell that's since been removed, and that hedge would have obscured the driver from Mr. Richardson's vantage point, and it also obscured the roadway for the driver. The driver pulled straight out across the lanes of travel. It appeared he was turning left. Mr. Richardson had two choices, either to slam on his brakes to try to avoid the vehicle or to veer to the left to try to avoid the vehicle. He chose to veer to the left. The young man that was driving the vehicle apparently was not looking, and he continued in his path, and the two vehicles collided, and Mr. Richardson's vehicle hit the decedent's vehicle in a T-bone fashion. After the accident, Mr. Richardson got out of his vehicle. He tried to render aid to the driver, but the driver succumbed at the scene. Although it was slightly raining, the accident reconstructionist that testified on behalf of the state at the preliminary hearing said that the moisture on the road would not have affected the coefficient of friction, so the weather was not a contributing factor to the accident. The Provo City police officers who testified in the case both testified that the decedent was guilty of improper lookout when the collision occurred. Mr. Richardson enjoys just up until this time, an unblemished work history. He was well regarded by everyone in the department. He was, and his fellow officers in the community, there was an active shooting incident. He was going to a SWAT situation, and he was in his private vehicle, which was not equipped with any emergency red and blue lights. He was traveling with the speed of traffic on 9th East and Provo, which is a wide, straight street. You can easily see up and down the street. He was traveling with the speed of traffic until traffic cleared, and then he did speed up, and he was going approximately 20 to 23 miles over the speed limit at the time the decedent pulled out from the Taco Bell. We presented some mitigating information at the administrative law hearing, and most of that is what I've just indicated to you are factors I consider to be mitigation. There is one important thing that was not presented to the administrative law judge, and we would like to present by way of mitigation. And as a result of the Utah Constitution being amended to provide for victims' rights, and there's been also some statutory amendments to the Utah Code which allows victims to have input in cases, the decedent's family in this case was advised of all the proceedings and attended all of the proceedings either by WebEx or in person. And Mr. Spencer, who's the decedent, left a father and a mother and several siblings. I'd like to read to you a letter that Mr. Spencer, the decedent's father, sent to Mr. Carpenter, the chairman of the Post Council. If I get a little emotional, I'm usually not an emotional guy, but this letter does make me a little bit emotional for a number of different reasons. Dear Chairman Wade Carpenter, my name is Wesley Spencer, and I am the father and personal representative of Joseph Kent Spencer, the driver who was killed in the collision involving Mr. Richardson on March 16, 2021. The death of my son was tragic and devastating, the unfortunate outcome of a confluence of many factors and variables. It is my understanding that your counsel will be meeting to determine what sanctions, if any, are appropriate to be issued against Mr. Richardson. I appreciate the role that Post serves to provide oversight pertaining to the conduct of our peace officers. I believe it serves the public well to thoroughly review and investigate incidents in which the life of a citizen is lost to the actions of law enforcement officers. Because loss of life cannot be restored, thorough review and analysis of the circumstances, policies, and chains of decision within those circumstances is critical to bring about necessary changes that will prevent future loss of life. I believe such a process is the only sensible way to respect the deceased, their survivors, and the community. I do not believe that highlighting the actions of only one person within a system can accomplish such change. As head of the family of Joseph Spencer, I am writing to let you know that our position and our request is one of leniency, and he's underlined leniency. I do not desire to see Mr. Richardson suspended or terminated. Although I know nothing of Mr. Richardson's record as an officer, I believe he loves and is committed to serving this country, its Constitution, and the community. From the beginning, he has repeatedly expressed his deep and sincere remorse for what happened, and we have completely forgiven him, as we believe our Joseph would want. Moving forward, we believe that it is important that we hold to that position for our sake and for the community. We truly want the best for Mr. Richardson and his family and for this tragic event to be transformative in positive ways in the lives of all who were affected by it. We hope you will consider our desires as you deliberate decisions regarding Mr. Richardson's future. And again, just summarizing, they say, I do not desire to see Mr. Richardson suspended or terminated. And I think victims always have a right in any kind of case in the state of Utah, whether it's criminal, and this, I know this isn't a criminal proceeding, but I think victims speak loudly, and the council should defer to the victims in this case. They were present at every hearing. They're very familiar with the facts of the case. And based upon their analysis, and I think they certainly can look at a lot more unbiasedly than I can because I was representing Mr. Richardson, but in view of the fact that they're representing the family, they were there at every proceeding, I think that their position in this case speaks volumes and that the council ought to defer to their wishes. I don't know if you have any questions of me. I know Mr. Richardson would like to briefly address the council.
Any questions for counsel?
Yes. Is there a point that he could have gotten to his patrol car to make that travel?
I'm not assigned to the patrol car. I'm Okay. I was picking up a SWAT vehicle that we use as a shield for active shooting.
Yeah, it's a 65,000-pound vehicle. Mr. Richardson was the only person that was trained to operate that vehicle on that day.
So you were in transit to pick up the SWAT truck, is that correct? Correct.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Go ahead, Mr. Richardson.
Honorable Post Counsel, I appreciate you hearing my case. I've been involved in public service for around 30 years. I've completed two post academies in California, two post academies in Utah, along with structure firefighter training and as a paramedic. I believe in the justice system. I know what you do is important. The recommendation that the post investigators is making is for 3 years. It's been almost 3 years that this has been litigated. We're about 2 months away. What I'm requesting is, in deference to the family, that their request not be for nothing. I'm just asking that 2 months might be allowed, not necessarily in my behalf, but in their behalf. I'm assuming once those 3 years are up, I'm going to go back into the service in our community. We were talking about instructor development. I was an instructor development teacher in post for 12 years. I've enjoyed spectacular support from my department and my community, and I'm looking forward to paying them back. Thank you. If you have any questions.
I was just going to ask if you're still employed.
I'm employed. I've been on leave since March 16th, 2021. Sir?
I was the same question. So you've been not functioning as a police officer for the entire time?
No. I've been on administrative leave the whole time.
Administrative leave?
Yes, sir.
I have a question for post-investigators. It was just to follow up Sheriff Wimmer's original question. Just want a clarification on it. You said the administrative judge did not make a ruling on whether or not, or decision on whether or not speed contributed to this accident. Was that correct? Is that what I heard? That he did not make a finding?
There was no finding as to whether or not the victim's vehicle would have been able to safely transit if the speeds were correct.
But then you said that you decided that it was. And so my question is, how can you articulate why the judge did not make a finding, but you kind of have?
The ALJ didn't find necessary to make that finding. The finding, you've got the findings from, in fact, and conclusions of law from administrative law judges in front of you, but the conclusion, I believe, by the ALJ was that where Mr. Richardson had entered a plea in abeyance in criminal court to the charge of negligent homicide under the definitions set in statute and administrative code, that is sufficient to count as a conduct establishing conduct that constitutes a state crime. And if you look at the notice also discusses the speed. I apologize. If you look at the findings also discusses the speed that Mr. Richardson was traveling at. So I think the ALJ didn't find it necessary to resolve that dispute in order to reach the conclusion we asked, which was whether there'd been a violation of criminal law to support a violation of 53.6.211.
But my question is that you have...
I'll answer that, Chief. So counsel's required to accept the administrative law judge's findings. Those findings are that he committed negligent homicide. Negligent homicide is if the actor acting with criminal negligence causes the death of another individual. And criminal negligence is defined as with respect to circumstances surrounding his conduct or the result of his conduct when he ought to be aware of substantial and unjustifiable risk that the circumstances exist or the result will occur. So that would be the finding that the ALJ made. Was that he kill somebody while driving with criminal negligence?
So I understand that. So, but my question pertains to that you said that as investigators, you have come to the conclusion that that was a factor. So my question is, what did you base that on? Was it speed? Was it on the traffic accident where it sounds like Provo found the victim was at fault?
if I heard correctly.
The Provost Police, I believe, is the testimony of counsel. The post's position comes from the accident reconstructionist's testimony at the preliminary hearing and the accident reconstructionist's report. The accident reconstructionist that was employed by the investigating law enforcement agency and who worked with the prosecutor on this matter. So that's where the factual base. Sorry, I wasn't trying to dodge your question. I was just trying to be clean with the administrative record.
I just wanted a clarification. Thank you.
Right, one other question. So as I'm reading this, the first assignment says that the conclusion of law is count one as a Class B misdemeanor. That's what I'm reading on here. So, but we're looking at a Class A.
Correct.
Maybe it's homicide to Class A under the
Utah Code. But this is what I'm seeing on the conclusion of law.
If you look at the last page of the findings of fact, page 5, it indicates that that's a Class A misdemeanor, so I think it's just a typo on the first page. And the actual conclusion and the order entered by the ALJ would be the latter severity of offense that would be binding.
Go ahead, Mayor.
There's no dispute that he was responding to an actual call of a school shooting?
Active shooter.
There was an active shooter. Shots had already been fired at officers.
You had no other means to get to this vehicle other than your own vehicle.
Correct.
I'll make a motion. One more question. So also just to clarify, so you entered into a plea and abeyance on Class A, and once that plea and abeyance is completed, this will be reduced to a Class B, just to clarify the Class A, Class B conversation.
That's correct.
Okay. How far are you from the plea and abeyance completion? When did that begin?
I believe it would be December of 2024 would be the completion.
It was on June 23rd, 2022. I think it was for 24 months. Is that correct?
18 months.
Okay, so you're almost complete with that.
He's almost complete.
So within the next 2 months, it'll be reduced to a Class B.
Correct. Yes.
Are there any letters of support from Utah County, from Sheriff's Office?
Well, there's a sheriff's deputy here.
Pardon me?
My chief of my division is here.
However, we can hear from his legal counsel, but
I would suggest the fact that he's still employed is a show of support, and I'm ready to make a motion, unless there's other questions.
Any other questions?
So in light, hugely, and part of the letter that we just heard, I would make a motion that we do a 2.5-year suspension, deviating a little bit from the 3-year recommendation.
Starting from the Ministry of Relief?
We're
2 months, so this buys, just gets him past the 2 months, in my understanding. Is that correct? 2.5 years?
Yes, sir.
We had a second right there.
So we got a second here?
And that's from the date of March 16, 2021, which was the administrative leave date.
Yes, that'd be correct.
As I understood from that.
So we got a motion and a second. Do we have any other discussion?
Who was the second?
Maybe a clarification.
Mayor Walker.
I just want to ask one question.
Go ahead.
During the investigation, with the youth, I guess, was it ever found that he was on a cell phone?
That is, I can respond to that. There was a reference to an officer looking at the cell phone and thinking that it was being used, but there was nothing more definitive than that. When we had an expert look at the cell phone, he could not tell that there was anything being transmitted at the time. There was, when the collision occurred, there was food spread all over the interior of the vehicle, and it appears that the decedent may have been eating at the time of the collision.
Well, it's not clear exactly.
Yeah, it's not.
Okay, we'll go ahead and call for the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Q.
Can we get some
clarification? The date on the separation, because so I know he's, March, in terms of formal agency action, March there was a letter 16th, for reprimand.
So my understanding is that it was March 16th, 2021, and it was for a reprimand of 2.5 years of deviation from the 3 years. Is that correct?
I'm sorry. Mr. Richards, were you placed on administrative leave on March 16th?
Yes, sir. After the incident. I've been on paid leave since then.
Okay.
Is that clear? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The next matter we have before the counsel is the matter of Jason Ricks. I do believe Mr. Ricks is present. Although I'm happy to wait until Mr. Ricks returns before I resume, unless you'd prefer me to start.
Let's go ahead and wait for him to return.
Oh, sorry. You were walking down the hall. I apologize. Just didn't want to get started without you here, sir. Mr. Ricks is a certified law enforcement officer whose certification is currently inactive following his retirement in, I believe, June of 2021. He has 23 years of service and was primarily employed by Utah Highway Patrol. Mr. Ricks has waived to allegations that he violated 536211(1)(c) by committing with possession or use of a controlled substance on two occasions. The facts in this matter are that Mr. Ricks applied to reactivate his law enforcement officer certification in December of 2023, and on his reactivation application disclosed that on one occasion in 2006, he used his wife's prescription Percocet on a single occasion. Percocet is a Schedule II controlled substance. And then he also disclosed that sometime in the 2017 to 2018 timeframe, he used his wife's prescription Ambien on three or four occasions over the course of no more than a couple of weeks. As a result of the disclosed use of controlled substances, that would make this a Category B and D offenses. The baseline range for a Category B offense is 3 years. The guideline range is 1.5 years to revocation. POSA is recommending the lowest that it's allowed to recommend, which would be 1.5 years. The substantial mitigating circumstances here are that this is a self-report. POSA would have no way to identify absent the self-report. It's been a very long time since the conduct that occurred here, particularly the 2006 offense that was 17 or 18 years ago. The use of the drugs was not for recreational use. There's no indication of impact on job performance. Aggravating circumstance, of course, is that there's multiple two offenses. Happy to answer questions. Again, all this was disclosed in Garrity interviews.
Do we want to bring up the letter?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. There's a
letter of support from Colonel Rappage. Colonel, where he's not employed now, would you like to recuse yourself, yes, as you have a letter included? For the record, Colonel will recuse himself, and if you'll refer to the letter dated January 5th, 2024, I'll give you a minute to read that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to recuse myself as well. I was a peer to Jason. I work at DPS at this time.
Okay. Also, for the record, Executive Deputy Director Garcia will also recuse himself. We'll give you a moment to review the letter. everybody had a chance to read that. Any questions for counsel?
No questions for you, Mr. Assistant. Opportunity to address the council.
Yeah, I appreciate this opportunity. I guess the only thing that I want to say is there was no abusive intent with this. The first case was kind of a, I guess you could say, a trial. I was just seeing what the effect it would have. I was experiencing some knee pain at the time, and it was a one-time usage. The second time is pretty much comes down to procrastination on my part. I was working graveyard shifts, would take a sleeping pill so I could help get some sleep before that shift, use over-the-counter, ran out over-the-counter, ended up using some stuff out of my own medicine cabinet, like was mentioned, that was prescribed to my wife. No justification. I knew better. Shouldn't have done it. And I'm sorry that we're here. I apologize for the time that you're spending on this. Sorry for the time that Sergeant Barnett has spent on this investigation. That's probably what's besides taking the prescription drugs, eating at me the most, is that I'm the result of this because of the poor decisions that I've made. I am looking at trying to get recertified, but I respect this process and will respect the outcome, whatever that is, and will, once that's resolved, move forward as I'm allowed. But appreciate your time in this manner. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
So you said you were using over-the-counter medication. Had you ever had a prescription for?
I had never had a prescription for either for pain relief or sleep aid.
Can you tell me when you last worked as a peace officer or was last able to work as a peace officer?
I retired in May of 2021 and have worked since, but not as a peace officer.
Just need a clarification on when this suspension would then technically start.
I guess when was the last time? When did you guys take action? When was it submitted?
I'm sorry, are you asking when the notice was submitted?
So yes, the notice was submitted.
The notice was sent last week, I believe. Was it Wednesday?
I can ask that. So Mr. Ricks had applied. I reviewed the application in December and jumped right on his case knowing that there was a reactivation test coming up in January. So we jumped on the case to get through. His application was correct and honest, but the conduct that occurred is what we investigated. And so we started this in December, got it approved and sent to him last week. And that he has been past the 18 months, which requires him out of law enforcement for 18 months, which requires the reactivation and not just get back in. So he's been out for more than 18 months.
And then to answer, I suppose.
Start back when he was out of law enforcement. 18
yes.
months ago is when the suspension would start then. So the year and a half, he would already be.
So the 18 months was from your retirement date, is that correct?
That's when it would start.
Yes, that's when the clock would start. Okay.
And that would be April 20th of 2021. I'm sorry, I misspoke earlier. April 30th of 2021 was when he retired. Is that correct?
Suspension would be up, correct? Okay.
Correct. Any questions? Any further questions?
I just have a question for clarity, right, just for consistency. Maybe someone from Post can help me with this, but in the past cases that we've had before us where someone was not employed, it seems to me, if I'm not remembering it incorrectly, that the suspension has generally started on the date that the Post Council takes action. Although I think we can deviate from that in a specific case for a specific reason, we just have to do it as part of the motion before the council. But am I correct or incorrect?
Last working as law enforcement.
It's last time he exercised law enforcement powers.
Yeah.
I think there may have been some cases we've taken action that way as well, though. So
it may have occasionally happened. I think the ordinary practice is the last date for an officer who's retired or been terminated or who's no longer acting, then it's been the last date they exercise law enforcement powers or had the ability to do so as a certified officer. So really the gap only primarily comes up with retired folks. And also post-council's guidelines, if you look at number one, kind of set the guidelines that post-council has adopted, has discusses that absent any extenuating circumstances to the contrary, the officer will receive credit for time served based upon the last date the officer was able to function as a peace officer, which in this case would have been April 30th of 2021.
And I think additionally within this case, some mitigating factors, I mean, he was honest about it, that when his wife reminded him, right, which we all forget things that our spouses conveniently remind us, sometimes at really opportune times, but that he, as soon as that was brought to his attention, put them on his application. And also with the infrequency of that and the intention behind it, I think that's, you know, he didn't do it knowing he was breaking the law, which I understand is not an excuse. In this case, I think that it was relatively a benign use. We're not talking to someone who is recreationally going out and using marijuana to have fun. Was it a misjudgment? But also there's been many years that have passed and he disclosed that.
Agree.
Any further questions?
Do we have a motion?
I move that we accept post recommendation with times to begin on April 30th, 2021.
I'll second that.
We've got a second from Sheriff Sparks. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
The last matter. Losing all my voice. The last matter before the council is the certification of Landon Wall. He was not employed at the time in which he engaged in this conduct. And he has no years of service. Substantiated allegation is willfully falsifying information to obtain certification, which falls under category C of the post-disciplinary guidelines, which is a two-year baseline, and POST is recommending those 2 years. A summary of the facts are as follows. On January 10th, 2022, Wall submitted an application to attend basic training and did not document any drug use. Wall participated in POST Ethics 1040 class, which thoroughly discusses the need to properly disclose all drug-related use. Wall then submitted an addendum that disclosed that he had used marijuana on one occasion in 2017. Wall applied to work for the Southern Utah University Police Department during an employment polygraph examination for SUU. Wall admitted that he had used marijuana a total of five times and Adderall on two different occasions. During a Garrity interview with Post, Wall admitted he intentionally failed to disclose the marijuana use because he was afraid it would prevent him from attending basic training.
Any questions for counsel? I don't see Mr. Wall. Is he here? See no one rising? Any questions for counsel? Hearing none, I'll call for a motion.
Make a motion to accept.
Got a motion to accept from Sheriff Bloomer. Second.
I have a question. I second, but I have a question. What would be the date on this? I don't see a date with
Because he was not employed, he has never been employed. That's
started. So that would be, I would today. Propose to start today if that's okay for your motion.
Okay, I'll second.
Second. Okay, got a first and second. We have any further discussion? And then I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll now turn the time over to Director Reese.
I don't want to touch it to get me sick. Good morning, Council. We've been moving through things very quickly, getting a lot done. But I wanted to take the opportunity to report back to you on several items and also get some feedback and hear your thoughts and opinions on directions that you'd like to see POST going. The first issue I wanted to talk, report back on some of the discussions we've been having that Chief Swanson wanted me to look at
on the lawful permanent resident discussion on what our post standards were, and or should we continue with the same standards, or is there a way to improve them? So it was a good opportunity for me to evaluate where we were at and how we got here. And with the change of the law a couple years ago that was giving people an opportunity who were non-citizens to be certified, I reviewed how we got there. And in fact, and Chief Swanson and I met with Marcus and Rich, and also Captain Newland arranged for us to meet with a federal ICE attorney to help us answer a lot of the complicated questions that we have when it comes to immigration status. Long story short, after reviewing it, we found that my recommendations, our legal recommendations, that we're going to stick with the same standard, which we were kind of forced to stay with the five-year LPR standard. And some of the dynamics that we found was just in case everyone wasn't familiar, I wasn't totally familiar with all the guidelines. In order for them to have a weapon, they have to have the LPR status. So that's the one part. Then the other part is, well, how long? And the code was written, and it referenced in the country legally, the Utah code, for 5 years. And anyone can jump in if I'm massacring this. And then so that became a big part of the question, too. What was in the country legal? And, of course, I think most of us, our concern here is, are we providing, are we able to tap into the resources there of DACA status? And what we found is that we couldn't be more aggressive on the DACA status because DACA is not considered legal in the country. So in the way the code was written, that 5 years in legally, it would have to be under the other window would be with some type of other visa. And that gets very complicated on the visas, time frame, when they're here, when they're not. Also, the access to that information from us from federally is difficult. And long story short, that's what we found was the five-year LPR was the most practical to implement. Chief Swanson and I think, asked the attorneys every question we could think of to try and find a way that we could be more aggressive in that. And essentially, we were shut down at every avenue of the law. Chief, did you have any other comments on that?
Well, everyone understands this particular scenario is I had a kid who was brought into the United States when he was two, grew up and lived in Ogden his entire time, graduated from high school, was a DACA, all right? Got a job, has been working the whole time, applied with Ogden before he had his green card and was turned down because he didn't have the green card, which you got to have. Got his green card, applied with us, thinking that he has been here legally this whole time. And I didn't understand myself that DACA was not here legally. Being a DACA person, you're still here illegally. And I didn't know that.
And this was a perfect case for the chief to bring up. It was for us to look at the process, because I think he was the perfect candidate of someone we were trying to be more aggressive with. And that we found the DACA status basically means essentially that federally they're choosing to allow them to not prosecute the law. That's basically what DACA means. And it can change the drop of a hat by administrations also.
It's an executive order.
Yes, correct? Yes, so. Yes, well put, thank you. So essentially, it was a perfect case for us to reevaluate our process. And I'm glad to report that our process, I think, is solid, but I think we were all hoping that we could be a little more aggressive in it. And right now, the way the laws are written, we can't. So I wanted to report back to you on that. Chief, does that sound good? But,
so accepted. Well, he's going to serve his time and try again.
So he has to have his green card.
He has his green card. He's got it according to the rule, not to the law. The law is not specific on that. The law just says be here legally for 5 years and have a green card. It doesn't say you have to have your green card for 5 years. But the administrative rule says you have to have the green card for 5 years.
So hopefully that was helpful for all of us. Any concerns? was a perfect case to look at. So thanks, Chief. I also wanted to report at last meeting we had we promoted Captain Newland to the deputy director position, that leaving a vacancy open for basic post-basic lieutenant. So we're ready to start the process to search for to fill that basic lieutenant. I was hoping to have two council members involved in that process, and I was hoping to have one sworn and one unsworn participate in the first stage of interviews. So I was looking for volunteers.
I'll volunteer for sworn.
Someone who's an unsworn.
Okay. Thank you. I'll follow up with you at the schedule, and then also I wanted to advise the council we're going to start this process. We're doing a statewide search, and we're looking for basically we're looking for people that would meet the criteria of a lieutenant. And to lead, to be kind of the direct supervision over the basic training program. So I've been out actively recruiting for about the past month, and I think we're going to have some highly qualified people put in. But if you have people that are interested, I encourage them to watch for the announcement.
Are you going outside? Is that what you're
saying? Yes.
Do they have to already have been sergeant or something?
Essentially, I think my impression, a typical lieutenant requirement, at least currently a sergeant with years of experience supervising at that level. And then, of course, we're going to be looking for somebody that with training that's going to be an asset to post with a training background and a passion to help basic training, hopefully. Any other comments or feedback on that? Okay, thank you. And then a couple other items I wanted to talk about. I wanted to hear from the council on just things that I keep hearing discussed, some of the medical marijuana issues, specifically as it relates to corrections. And I've had a lot, since I've been in the spot, I've had a lot of questions regarding this. And our big issue with the medical marijuana laws passing, of course, it's made things a little complicated. So right now, the big issue with us in law enforcement is federally, if someone has used marijuana within the last 2 years, I think that's accurate, 1 year?
1 year.
1 year. That's basically, they just can't possess a firearm. And so, and the, so a lot of, we're having to turn away a lot of people that don't fit that criteria because of the firearm. But then, it's also on our correction in the corrections area where we have corrections officers who are not carrying armed. Right now, there's not a window for us to certify them, but we would like to find ways to certify we can't circumvent the federal law but if they're not in an armed position, we're looking at options to certify them. I'd like to hear your feedback, agree, disagree, or ideas.
I just read, if I just pull it up, Nevada, just recently, you're probably aware of this, recently changed their hiring policy. Apparently some of the marijuana offenses, they don't consider them as a deterrent any further to get hired. Maybe that is applies to what you're talking about. I don't know how they're getting around the federal law, but I just read that article.
Same thing we did when we imposed medical marijuana. We just did it.
This is about a policy. It's not a deterrent from applying. Apparently, you don't have to.
I'm not aware of that, but it's is that for armed officers?
I think it's all their officers. Yeah, I mean, they just approved it. Like it says, I don't know, a month ago. I'll send you the article.
And that, yeah, would you please? Because that's these are where we're at too. We're all kind of hoping that things change, and I think we assume that in a few years down the road, it's not going to be an issue. But it is an issue right now, so I'll definitely... Colonel.
So one thought I had, so the federal law requires you can't possess a firearm, basically if you disclose that you're a medical marijuana user, because it preemptively suggests that you're a chronic user. So they if we gave them certification as a correctional officer, if they ever were in possession of a firearm, they would lose their certification because they'd be in violation of a federal crime at that point.
And technically, the administrator would too.
because it says you cannot provide a firearm to somebody if you're aware.
So, good qualification.
Yeah, yes. And that's, you know, the only way we could envision any way right now to, you know, currently is to put, it would put some pressure, like, if do the sheriffs really want that?
We would have to have someone who not only is not going to carry a firearm, but is going to basically commit that they are never going to be in possession of a firearm as a certified correctional officer.
In that capacity, yeah. Yes, yes.
Within a year of having the medical marijuana card.
So I guess, is it, right now, is it worth going down that path?
I can only speak for my own agency. All my corrections are required to be certified when we issue them weapons. So it, to me, it's a moot point. Until they change federal law, I think we status quo.
So we've talked about this. If you remember Dr. Stevenson, we talked about this about 4 or 5 years ago when the medical marijuana thing came up. It was addressed for the sheriffs. Sorry, I'm pointing at some of the sheriffs, but it was addressed for some of the sheriffs in regards to whether or not they wanted to hire. And how we decided in that meeting was we were just going to continue as is. But it is really up to the sheriffs. It could be finagled, but again, it would have to be with the sheriffs to identify, yes, they are certified, but they cannot own, possess, maintain or even touch a firearm during that time period for 1 year from when they used medical marijuana, they had a medical marijuana card or any of the above. So,
or legally out of state.
Or legally, yes, or used illegally.
Stop thinking of Brownies.
It's not just the sheriffs.
The sheriff's side as well. I don't have any of my deputies would anytime have a job where they don't have to carry a firearm. So the only place I could think of is if you have a very large department, so maybe Salt Lake County or Department of Corrections. You may have some guys that will never handle a firearm, but they do firearms as part of their advanced basic corrections academy. So you'd have to bypass that. But I think for the sheriff's office, it would be pretty consistent. Everybody's expected to carry a firearm, qualify with a firearm.
Yeah, I'm in remote rural Utah. And my correction guys just about have to because either transports, medical incidences, mental health incidents, we even use them if we have a large crime scene to come help secure the crime scene while the officers are doing officer stuff. So, and they're all armed. That would put a real hurt on them.
Same for us, Travis. We're actually trying to expand opportunities for correctional officers to transfer back and forth between the Law Enforcement Bureau, AP&P, and corrections. So I think it would create more challenges for us, actually.
This is exactly the kind of feedback I needed. Thank you so much.
We have President Willem from the Chiefs Association here. I think that stands great for the guard as well.
I'm glad I asked. Brought it up because it keeps coming up from different angles, and I wanted to know the council's opinion. And then the other issue that comes up often, I'd like to just hear your thoughts on, is the 16-hour annual training requirements and how, for my short time being here, in the short term, we've been trying to find ways, or my overall strategy is as much as possible, I'd like the approval of training hours done by the department heads as much as possible. I think that's been some of the biggest frustration for our agencies. And so I wanted you to know that that is my strategy, is to try and do that as much as possible. And how we get there is a couple different options. I think some of our most frustrating things are the mandated training that's mandated annually that might be more effective if we could get it on another schedule that was not the same stuff every year. I'd like to hear your thoughts and comments.
I'm all for it. So you guys have heard me, and I told the same thing to the governor. I think it becomes white noise when you have to do the same thing every year. So in my opinion, is I'd like to see at least on year one, we make sure we do the full 16 hours and then a refresher. So basically year 3 or year 5, I'd like to see it before year five, a second time, because year one, you're learning so much. It's going to get washed out. So I'd like to see it come back again to 16 hours at year three, then jump to year six, year 10, and then year every 5 years, make sure you do the full 16 hours. The other years, I'd like to see just a basic 1 to 2 hour refresher. So, hey, here's the new trends, here's the new things. But every 5 years at least, making sure you're doing the full 16 hours. Otherwise, I think it becomes white noise, and they just don't care.
And I agree. I would say it's not just white noise. It's actually detracting from our ability to do more advanced training that, depending on the position that you hold, that becomes very important. So, and I think, again, there's probably a number of different ways to do it, either a five-year rotation or rotate each subject every year, so it's like a 3 or 4 year rotation.
And just to clarify on the rotation, just logistically to do that, I think for us to track it, we would have to at least set the rotation so everyone's rotating the same. We couldn't do a free to manage it logistically. A free for all would be very difficult for post.
But I think we had some good discussions in here about broadening what's accepted into that 16 hours, you know, less lethal, harm reduction training, you know, things that were previously not accepted because it didn't fit into the silo that the legislature created. And so I like the idea of a department head, you know, the head of a department saying, oh, this applies to our 16 hours. I don't mind there being a 16-hour mandate, as long as we open the training of what is accepted as that training broadly enough to where I can make some good decisions on what's pertinent to what's going on in Tooele County. A lot would probably argue with this, but there's an argument to be made that deadly force is a way of reducing harm. You know, it solves a situation. And so I don't know that having firearms included in that 16 hours, along with less lethal, isn't appropriate. Because there's all, yeah, especially with don't shoot and don't shoot scenarios that are so readily available to us with simulators nowadays. And they're getting more broadly accepted. You know, and as we look at school safety and what they're looking at allowing in schools, that's even more important training that needs to be available to probably broader than law enforcement as we move forward. But I don't mind the 16-hour mandate as long as that encompasses some of what we're already doing. You know, half the time the legislature legislates based off of ignorance. They don't really know what we do already. And, you know, it's kind of like we go back to the chokeholds. I've never used or even seen used a chokehold in my mid-20-year career. But yet they had this idea that they need to legislate against it as though it was being used all the time. But the reality is they wrote a piece of legislation that solved something that wasn't a problem in the state of Utah. And, I know. I guess what I'm saying is, you know, trying to track and mandate what years we do so many hours probably isn't necessary as long as we have a sufficient flexibility in, you know, what mental health training am I doing this year? And what mental disability are we doing this year? Because this stuff is a moving target, and I think we need to move with it.
And that, again, coming in and looking at some of these challenges as I came in, that's what I found is I was watching some of the past council meetings and seeing the frustration, and my mindset is, and the post team's mindset is we want to be as aggressive as we can in approving the stuff that's being submitted by the agencies. However, I'm quickly finding how locked in the codes, the way the legislation is written, that I'm like going, oh, we can't. And so there's a little bit of that. As we've been looking at ways to be more helpful to the agencies, Marcus has identified the potential of the director, in the short term, the director being able to delegate the authority of some of these approvals to the department heads. And so we're looking at potential processes where it may be where the department heads sign off that they meet the code and then submit it to post and we log it. Those are some of the ideas we're thinking about, and I wanted you to know, and I wanted to hear from you to make sure we're on the right track. Captain.
I think just to clarify that process, what we're envisioning if we go down that road is, because we don't want to, I think, contravene legislative intent either, but we do have, I think, this possibility. I think post preference might be to get a legislative change in that statute that agency heads may do it. But what we envision is post would still promulgate the descriptions that would meet statutory requirements. We would still intake the training and the descriptions, and we would serve as sort of a clearinghouse for anyone that wanted to do an audit. However, the liability and the decision would shift to agency heads. And I think that's how we'll
take it.
Yeah, that would be nice.
But I do want to stress that would be the liability for an audit as well.
Right.
Not just the decision.
We'll take that too.
Yeah. Well, I guess the question is, as far as the legislation as it now stands, do you have an idea of which portions would need to be changed to allow the flexibility? And have you had those conversations with any legislators?
We're in process, yeah. And then a part of I think I need all of your help also to have those conversations. Deputy Executive Director.
So just coming from a small agency, I MOAT PD, the challenge was you don't want to take away our autonomy to be able to create the training. These are required training hours, but it becomes difficult to actually bring in experts related to autism awareness or de-escalation or mental health and all those things. So I like the idea of having it on a rotation. Also, I like the idea of post creating that curriculum so our officers can log in, take the training. It's consistent across the state. They can do it on their own time. Because from the Department of Corrections standpoint, our officers, we can't just pull them off of their posts either right now. That's as shorthanded as we are. That creates a big challenge for us. So I guess I'm just saying if there's a way to create that consistency for posts, that would be great. And then just piggybacking on Sheriff Sparks as well. You know, the demographics of our profession has changed significantly over the past 5 to 10 years. We've lost our middle class of expertise, and we're using these 16 hours because it's a requirement, and we're not able to train the core competencies of the job when we have people that have been in this profession only 1 to 3 years. And that's where we need to be spending our time, is teaching them how to do the basics, and we're losing that opportunity.
Very well said.
Yeah, thank you.
So based on council voting on the descriptions, we opened up very broad to arrest control. We did put in less lethal. That was one. So arrest control is anything the rate of amounting to any use of force in regards to effecting an arrest. De-escalation, we've opened that up very broadly, saying anything involves even VIRTRA training. If they say as part of VIRTRA training or simulated training, there is a component that they make the effort to de-escalate before the shoot type thing. Crisis intervention, we open that up broadly to include any kind of mental illness or crisis response. And it's a response, and that was the intent of the legislature, was a response. Agencies do have some constraint with that when they want to include officer wellness and resiliency type topics where it's not necessarily immediate response, it's long-term officer health. That's one with crisis intervention. The special needs was very narrowly defined as autism only, and council voted to open that up to any type of developmental disability. We see different people coming in with Down syndrome, fragile X. So we see the agencies responding to this and opening up. The only one that is very still narrow, and it's because of the law, is the new sexual assault and abuse, because it refers to another part of the code that it narrowly defined what that description is. So we have been very, very broad. I've been the one accepting the training. We've been very broad and open with the agencies, and as long as they can articulate that somehow it fits within this very open umbrella, we've been accepting the training.
And John, I just want to make a plug to the Utah Prosecution Council to help champion that legislation. Trent Dressen, the new coordinator for that program, has actually been very, very helpful and pardon me, understanding of some of the sexual assault training that's coming in. So I just want to add that.
We've been talking with them because of that's the way that statute's written. We've had highly regarded experts teaching for different agencies who didn't meet the criteria. So we've been trying to address that.
I'm leaning on Trent with UPC to give us the yay or nay, and he's again been very helpful.
Any other feedback for me that you'd like to see us? Any other hot issues? I would love to hear from you.
I have one other issue with the beginning of the session starting next week. We discussed an issue, 6 or 9 months ago regarding the certification or ability for law enforcement cross state lines to be able to act in their capacity for some of rural Utah that is closer to Arizona. Or some of these other jurisdictions that have been, you know, had MOUs, et cetera. And we looked at that there were some issues in their ability to perform as a law enforcement officer given their lack of post-Utah Post certification. I was wondering if we'd resolve that or if we've worked with any legislators to have that resolved this session. It seemed like it was a relatively, you know,
That's a new issue to me. I would look to staff if they're aware of any.
I remember the discussions, right? This was specifically with, I think the issue came up with one county down by Arizona.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
I believe it was King County and Cocodillo.
Yes. Do you remember that discussion, David?
I think that we had a solution worked out for the sheriff down there, but.
Okay, I just want to make sure that was resolved and that we didn't need to approach it.
Yeah, as I recall, and I forgive me, this is memory, so don't trust me.
Okay. The
proposal, they had an agreement that was proposed, they wanted approval. The problem was cross-border individuals still need to show individual approval for true cross-deputization, and I think that still is going to be in place. We weren't able to have a more streamlined whole department solution because of the concern over the cross-state curricula. But I think that's been working for the county at the moment. I haven't heard anything.
Okay.
If your memory is different, Christian, or if somebody else.
No, that sounds about right. But if you're hearing from, you know, your counterparts that it's not solved, let us know and we'll see what else
okay.
we can do.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I didn't have anything else. I just really just want to thank you all for your guidance and support. There's a lot of tough challenges and decisions and strategies we need to make, and it gives me a lot of confidence that to hear from you guys and your direction that we're making solid decisions. I just wanted to say thank you.
Thanks for your responsiveness too.
What's that? We got to set a meeting.
Next meeting.
We have a recommended date.
April? Yeah, April looks a lot better than March.
Exercise the
last transition.
We're still having this. It's not the point yet. Mm-hmm.
Recommended dates.
April 16th.
I have a board meeting at 1 o'clock.
Would it be in April or March?
In April.
Generally, we would have, just for clarification, generally, this would be our December meeting, but because due to the holidays, so I believe we should be in March.
March 19th.
I have the same board meeting on March on the Tuesday, 19th, 1 p.m.
21st?
Well, it's March 1st.
Thursday?
First looks good.
Mm-hmm. First works.
Yep.
First works.
Thursday, 21st.
Yes.
Thursday, March 21st. Chief, you said Thursday, March 21st?
Yes.
Pretty sure that's my anniversary, this.
You're pretty sure the hard part.
You're welcome to bring your wife with you.
You could try the 26th or the 28th.
that'll be here.
Is post council here? 21st of March, 10 a.m. Right. We have a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
Third. Thank you for your time.